The Tom Woods Show, episode 1910.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're joined today, once again, by our old friend Vijay Boyapati. Vijay came onto my radar during the 2008 presidential campaign when he left his, I'm sure, nice job at Google because he decided he needed to go work for Ron Paul. He was so impressed by what he had to say. And since then, he's done some really great writing, and he's now got his first book called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. And he's a really, really smart, good, decent guy. And I thought this is just a natural for the show. So Vijay, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to speak to you again.
Now, some people, when they talk about being bullish on Bitcoin, mean it in a very limited, almost trivial sense that I have this good feeling I can make money with Bitcoin. But you are looking at this maybe more holistically when you think about being bullish. It's more that you think it has great long-term prospects, not necessarily exclusively as an investment vehicle, but because of what its vision is, because of what it can achieve and the likelihood that it will be able to reach its potential.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm most excited about Bitcoin because of its freedom-producing potential. And I really believe it is a technology which is and will be transformative to society. And certainly, I think my kids are going to benefit from this. Satoshi Nakamoto, when he first invented Bitcoin, was met with a lot of skepticism. A lot of people had tried to invent digital currencies before his attempt in 2008. But with his white paper, with the publication of his white paper, he had solved a fundamental problem in computer science that allowed for the transfer of value from one person to another person anywhere on Earth, near instantly, without any intermediaries. And this is something that has literally never been possible before in the history of the world. So I think it's incredibly transformative. And I think the ability for people to hold wealth and to easily protect it from government confiscation and to be able to easily transmit it is a very, very profound innovation to money. I think it's the most profound innovation to money in 1,000 years. So you're right. That when I talk about being bullish about Bitcoin, I'm bullish on its potential for humanity.
Now, I noticed that you don't call your book The Bullish Case for Crypto, and you're focusing specifically on Bitcoin. And some people might wonder, isn't it possible that another cryptocurrency could come along that maybe has better qualities than Bitcoin in some way? Is there a reason that you focus on Bitcoin specifically?
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand Bitcoin as a form of money and rather than as a piece of technology. And Bitcoin competes with other monetary goods and other monetary systems. It competes with gold and it competes with the fiat monetary system. And it's really on the attributes that make for a good money on which Bitcoin is competing. And Bitcoin is certainly superior to fiat money in a whole range of senses. It's even better than gold in a number of ways. It's more scarce than gold in the sense that the supply is completely capped. It's ultimate scarcity. There will never be more than 21 million Bitcoins, whereas the supply of gold increases by about 2% a year. And when you think about other cryptocurrencies, when Satoshi Nakamoto came up with his invention, it was something that was easy to copy. So it is a legitimate concern for someone to come along and to wonder whether a new cryptocurrency is going to outcompete Bitcoin. But to outcompete Bitcoin, it wouldn't have to have some new technological bells and whistles. It would need to be superior as money. It would need to have superior attributes as money. And if you look at these competing cryptocurrencies, most of them, I would say the vast majority of them, are just complete copycats. And they're really missing something that Bitcoin has, which is the credibility of those monetary attributes. And now this is a kind of deep question to get into. Where does this credibility come from? But just on its face, if you accept it, and we can dive into where that credibility comes from, most of these competing cryptocurrencies don't have that credibility. And most of them are created by people just with the hope to make money for themselves. They're creating them so they can do a pump and dump scam where they create their own version, say VJ Coin, and they control all of the supply. And they say, well, this is better than Bitcoin because it has this extra, you know, feature that Bitcoin doesn't have. And then when they get enough interest, they just dump the supply on the public and the price goes to zero. And that's actually generally what's happened over time with most of these cryptocurrencies, is that they just kind of fade into obsolescence as the people who created them, you know, dump their coins and leave. So the other thing that's, I think, really important to understand is the network effect. Once any product or service has a network effect, that is the increasing value of the product or service because it's the dominant product or service in its category, it's really hard to unseat. And an example of this is Facebook. Now, it could be the case that you thought you had a better version of Facebook, Tombook, and you know, you could copy Facebook's design. It's not actually that complicated to copy Facebook. And you could perhaps attract a few friends to Tombook, but really you're not going to be able to attract much more than that, because people want to go where other people are. They want to be on the service that everyone else is using. And Facebook has the dominant network effect. And the same is true for Bitcoin in the realm of digital currencies. It has an overwhelming network effect. There's a tremendous brand around Bitcoin. Everyone knows about Bitcoin as the digital currency. There's a huge amount of infrastructure being built around trading Bitcoin and being able to transfer your fiat currency such as dollars or pounds into Bitcoin, and financial infrastructure such as futures markets and shorting and buying on leverage. And all of these things have been built on Bitcoin, and they just simply don't exist for these other cryptocurrencies. So my view is that none of these other cryptocurrencies have improved on Bitcoin's monetary attributes. None of them have a network effect, and none of them have the financial infrastructure built around Bitcoin. So I think it's incredibly unlikely that any of them are going to surpass Bitcoin. I think it's gotten to the point of critical mass, and it's essentially game over in terms of the cryptocurrency space.
Let me ask you something that I see on social media sometimes when you bring up the 21 million cap that we all know exists with Bitcoin. There are people who look at Bitcoin as if it's some kind of a computer program that when nobody else is looking, somebody could break into and then just arbitrarily increase that 21 million. Why is that the wrong way to think about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, Bitcoin is a system that's decentralized. And what I mean by that is not a single piece of software running on one computer that could be turned off. It's not run by a single company either. It's not like PayPal, for instance. If the government ever decided that PayPal was harmful and it wanted to shut it down, they could go to PayPal's offices and say, shut this down or you're going to jail. And that would have a very quick impact on PayPal's service. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is a network where there are hundreds of thousands of computers running the Bitcoin software around the world in various different countries, various jurisdictions. And these computers are coordinating with each other to come to a consensus about who has how many Bitcoins and who's allowed to transact how many Bitcoins. And so if you go and shut down one of these computers, it doesn't affect the network at all. The network is very resilient to attack. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of people believe that Bitcoin is a very important innovation. This had never been possible before. And this is what I alluded to earlier on with Satoshi Nakamoto. He solved a problem in computer sciences, which was, how do you get a large number of computers in a decentralized network where they're not controlled by the same people, they don't necessarily have the same interests, political or economic interests, how do you get them to coordinate together in a way that allows them to benefit together? So Bitcoin's system is very resilient because of its decentralization. And I think we've seen that over time. We've seen a number of different governments try to attack Bitcoin and try to shut it down. And it has incredible uptime. It has been up continuously for the last decade without interruption, and very few services could boast that. If you look at Google or Facebook, even they have downtime where their computers go down for various reasons. But because of the fact that Bitcoin's run on so many computers, it's sort of protected from, you know, any number of them going down, because just new ones will spring up.
Let me ask you about the reason a lot of people are interested in Bitcoin is because they think they can make money with it, because they see it. You know, obviously there has just been a major correction, but we all have seen numerous cases in which there is a steady increase in the price, and people think, well, just like with any other thing that occasionally has increases in price, maybe I could make money or even a lot of money with it. How do you feel about people using, I would say a great many people interested in Bitcoin are using it as an investment vehicle, and who really aren't interested in its, you know, its world-changing possibilities. How do you feel about that? Are you okay with that? Is that all right?
Yeah, I'm totally okay with that, because I think it's a natural part of how markets work. And, you know, the Austrian story on the origins of money comes from Karl Menger. And, you know, I think most of your listeners would be somewhat familiar with Menger. And the idea is that, you know, humans at some stage in the past lived in a state of barter, which means that some people were fishermen, some people were farmers. And it was the case that, you know, people would try and trade with each other, but there's these huge inefficiencies to barter trade. So if I'm a fisherman and I have a fish and you grow apples, and I say, hey, Tom, can I have some apples? I'll give you a fish. And you reply, well, I don't like fish. I like bananas. And so what I learn over time is that I should accumulate something else that you like, or that you're more likely to like, and trade with you with that. And over time, that good becomes more and more marketable and eventually becomes money. And historically, that good, money, had certain attributes. And, you know, we know these attributes, we're pretty familiar with them. Like, generally, they're scarce, they're very portable, they're divisible, that sort of thing. Now, one thing I think isn't really talked about in the Austrian account of money, or the origins of money, that I think we've learned with Bitcoin, and I think is very important, is that in the process of monetization, in the process of something becoming money, it will increase dramatically in purchasing power, because as more and more people hold it and want to hold it for the purpose of using it for trade and for savings, its value will go up. So if you go back far enough in history, gold had very little value. It was just a rock on the ground. And then someone picked it up and thought this was cool, and they started, you know, using it for jewelry and ornamentation. And over time, it became money. And by the time it had become money in the 19th century, global money, it was incredibly valuable. The 1 ounce of gold could buy a lot. So to get back to your question, I think it's actually very natural for people to speculate on Bitcoin, because what they are seeing, although they may not know it, is they're watching the process of monetization and they're thinking, well, this is going up in value, so I'm going to bet that it's going to go up even more. And it's really interesting, because that hastens the process of monetization. The value of a monetary good going up is bringing it closer to that end state, which is global reserve money. And that's the role that gold had in the 19th century. It was the reserve currency of the world. It was used for settlement between banks and between countries. And that's what's happening to Bitcoin right now. And even if the people who are speculating on it don't understand it, they see that something is going on. They see the market prices moving, and entrepreneurs and speculators will always be there in any market situation watching prices and investing and speculating on those prices. That's just the market process at work.
All right, I want to ask you a terminology question, because I know there are a lot of people who would like to have this explained. And maybe to keep it as lay-friendly as possible, you might even explain it by analogy if possible. And that is, what is a fork? And is a fork a problem for Bitcoin? Is it a good thing, or is it neutral?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and it's a little bit technical, but I'm going to try your approach of using an analogy. Now, most people are familiar with the game of chess. Chess has a bunch of pieces: the rook, the queen, the bishop, pawns, etc. And chess also has a bunch of rules as well. And imagine if I came along and I said, well, I want to, you know, chess is kind of interesting, but I want to create my version of chess because I think my version of chess is better. And I'm going to keep all of the pieces, but I'm just going to change what the pieces can do. And that's kind of a rough analogy of what a fork is. It's kind of a copy of Bitcoin where the people who make the copy create a copy of Bitcoin's history of transactions. And the history of transactions is known as the blockchain. And then they change the rules that Bitcoin has. And those rules are things like what is the total supply, how many transactions can happen on the network per second, and things of that nature. And people have attempted to fork Bitcoin, which is like creating a copy of chess but changing the rules around because they think that they can create better rules. Now, you know, I personally don't believe that any of the forks have created superior rules to Bitcoin. There was a big contentious fork in 2017 and a big debate and argument about whether one of Bitcoin's most important rules called the block size rule, which is how big a block can be, and a block is just a list of transactions that happen on the Bitcoin network, that size should be increased. And there was a whole group of people who argued very passionately that this was very important, and they created a copy of Bitcoin. And the copy happened in such a way that if you owned one Bitcoin prior to the fork, you then owned one Bitcoin and one Bitcoin Cash token. So you owned one of each because they copied everything, including the history of who owned what. So the simplest way to say it is that it's a copy. And going back to my analogy, if I were to create a copy of chess and I changed the rules, okay, it might be slightly interesting, but what's the likelihood that that's going to become the dominant form of chess? What's the likelihood that people around the world are going to abandon the rules that they've been using for millennia and use Vijay's chess? It's very, very low. So that's, you know, that's my explanation for why, despite the creation of many forks in 2017, the value of those forks is very close to zero compared to Bitcoin. All of these copies that were created are worth almost nothing now. The market kind of figured out that the original vision is the best vision, and it's beneficial to all of us that it's very, very difficult to change Bitcoin because the harder it is to change, the less likely it is to be co-opted by any particular interest group or government or nation state. And that's a very important property for Bitcoin to have, that it can't be co-opted.
I know this is going to be such a noob sort of question, but I remember waking up one day and all of a sudden I had some Bitcoin Cash. And you said this is because they copied everything, including the owners of Bitcoin, which I had. How does that affect the 21 million limit? I don't understand that.
Yeah, a lot of people have that question and they think, well, is Bitcoin really scarce if people can create copies of it? And the way I like to think about that is if I create a copy of the Mona Lisa and I photocopy it or I get someone to actually paint the Mona Lisa, that doesn't increase the supply of Mona Lisas. It just creates copies. And in fact, it illustrates the singularity of the Mona Lisa, that there is only one and that all of these things that have been created are just copies of the original. And really that's, you know, just from the perspective of the market value, that's what we've seen. We've seen that the original has maintained the overwhelming majority, something like 98 or 99% of the total value or market capitalization today is in Bitcoin, and all of the copies together represent about 1% of the value of Bitcoin. So it's a very tiny fraction. So it doesn't affect the supply. Another way to think about it is to say, if I built my own Ferrari, is it a Ferrari? No, it's not a Ferrari. There's a difference, and it's fairly easy to tell the difference between a Ferrari and, you know, my copycat of a Ferrari.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. There is plenty of discussion of Bitcoin these days. A lot of I told you so's floating around out there and a lot of interest in it. And I have just the thing for people who are looking to add Bitcoin to their retirement account, looking to diversify their portfolio toward new innovative investments, or who just find the cryptocurrency world confusing and don't know how to get started. Well, some people are saying crypto assets present the best opportunity to build generational wealth since the discovery of oil. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption, and they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Well, go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. In your book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, you have a section in which you review what you call common misconceptions. And I want to focus on one in particular because of Elon Musk claiming that what's known as Bitcoin mining consumes too much electricity, he says. So he doesn't want to be part of that. I'd like to know how you respond to that. And I might add that the same kind of complaint has been made, and I'm reasonably certain even Milton Friedman made this complaint about gold, a similar complaint, which was that it's a waste of resources. If we can just use paper, then it's a waste of resources to dig up gold and go to all this trouble. Why should we bother? This is just a pure deadweight loss. And to me, I think that's a short-sighted way of looking at it, because what they're leaving out is the gold, it doesn't just give me no value at all. It gives me stable or increasing purchasing power. And without gold, all I would have is paper money that can be inflated at will. And so I would say the amount we spend on gold is a pittance compared to the benefit we get from it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you and I are both Austrians. And so we have thought about money deeply, and we've thought about the utility that money brings to society. And I think it was Warren Buffett who very condescendingly said, well, if an alien species came and looked at us, they'd think we're really irrational because we dig up gold from one part of the world and then we move it around and then we bury it in another part of the world. And this makes absolutely no sense. It makes no sense if you don't think about what role money has in society. Money has a very, very important role. It allows for social coordination. Without money, the advent of civilization would have been impossible. It allows for large groups who may be antagonistic with each other, towards each other, to coordinate and to do, you know, to have trade and to build the division of labor and to ultimately to create civilization. So it's incredibly important. The development of paper money really is sort of undermining those properties that make money so useful for the advent of civilization. So I completely agree with you on that sense. We need to look at the utility of money. But Elon Musk's concern is about the consumption of electricity. And again, as you know, people who are very liberty-minded and believe in Austrian economics, I think our first response would be, well, the consumption of energy goes hand in hand with the flourishing of human civilization. You know, humans used very little energy when we were hunter-gatherers. But do we want to live in a sort of state of existence where we live hand-to-mouth and could be ravaged by an animal, or, you know, if we get sick, we might die? We don't want to live in that state of nature. So the increasing consumption of energy is actually a reflection of the development of civilization. I think that's a very positive thing. But to give the strongest argument, I think it's always important to try and steel man the arguments of your intellectual adversaries rather than straw man them. And I think if I was going to give the steel man argument for what Elon Musk is saying is Bitcoin consumes all this energy and we're concerned about the world because if enough greenhouse gases are emitted, then we could get into a tailspin where the global climate, you know, gets out of control and then the Earth isn't a habitable place for any of us. Now, I personally don't believe that's true, but let's just sort of take that on its face value and say that's the concern that they're coming with. To that kind of concern, I would say you really need to look at the energy distribution, the energy consumed by Bitcoin, and what is the mix of energy? Is it consuming a lot of fossil fuels and emitting a lot of greenhouse gases? And actually, if you look at the consumption of Bitcoin energy by Bitcoin miners, The dominant case is that it goes towards places with renewable and excess power production. And a classic example of this is the Sichuan province in China, where they massively overbuilt hydroelectric dams and they have all this cheap electricity because the population in the particular area isn't large enough to consume all the electricity that was built. Now, this is an example of governments being very bad at managing an economy. They, you know, have massive overcapacity in one area and undercapacity in another. But it just happens to be that there's a lot of overcapacity of hydroelectric energy in the Sichuan province. This is somewhere that Bitcoin miners love to go, and it's one of the largest centers of Bitcoin mining on Earth, because Bitcoin miners, their primary input cost is electricity. So they're looking for places where electricity is essentially being thrown away. And why is it thrown away? It's thrown away because electricity is not really a fungible commodity. Electricity made in Sichuan province can't, you know, the excess can't be transported to Texas and used for something else. There is a very rapid decay of energy over distance. So you can't transport it very far. So the energy that's produced, the excess energy that's produced in Sichuan province was essentially just thrown away. So Bitcoin miners go there and they think, wow, this is really cheap. You're not even using this electricity. We're going to run our computers here because this is our primary input cost. So the carbon footprint of Bitcoin mining is actually very, very low, because the big centers of Bitcoin mining are places like Sichuan province, Wenatchee, which is near where I live in Seattle, where they have a big hydroelectric dam, and places like Iceland, which have a lot of geothermal energy. These are all places where Bitcoin mining tends to concentrate because miners are looking for that excess energy. And one of the coolest things about Bitcoin mining is that Bitcoin is this digital good that you can sort of transmit over the internet, which means you can do Bitcoin mining anywhere. All you need is power and an internet connection. And if you really believe in renewables, if you think that's important, you should actually be behind Bitcoin and support it, because it incentivizes the creation, the production of energy in places where renewable energies are available, but there may not necessarily be a big enough population to economically support it. So you can go to places like that and, you know, build a big Bitcoin mine and then make money off the development of renewables in that area and perhaps ultimately attract people to live in those areas. So even on the terms of someone like Elon Musk, even accepting his concerns as valid and legitimate, I think it's a big mistake to think Bitcoin is environmentally harmful.
So that, I think that's very well stated. Now, another issue that, now I didn't agree with that electricity claim, but I am concerned about, and you have here under real risks, the risk of state attack. Well, I think of what's been happening tax-wise with Bitcoin as a kind of state attack, because introducing the idea of capital gains into Bitcoin, that if I buy Bitcoin and the price of it rises and then I sell some of it, well, if I made a gain on it, I have to report that and be taxed on it. Now, if I made a loss, I can also report that, although the amount that that will reduce my taxable income is pretty pitiful. But it also applies if I go and buy an expensive car with Bitcoin. If I bought the Bitcoin back when it was 1,000 and then I bought a car with it when it was 50,000, I still am on the hook for the taxes. That's a severe, now granted, not a lot of people are necessarily complying with that, but supposedly they're going to crack down on it. That seems to me like a severe problem for the process of Bitcoin being fully monetized, that is to say, becoming a widespread, widely used medium of exchange. How do you overcome that?
I think that's a really insightful point, Tom. That state attack, usually when people talk about state attacks, they talk about the government banning Bitcoin. But I think you're absolutely correct. There are perhaps less serious forms of state attack, which is still an attack on Bitcoin. And taxation is definitely one of those, because it creates this friction for usage of Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. And you're absolutely right. If I own Bitcoin and it's appreciated in value and I think, wow, I've got some extra value here, I need to purchase something, the government's going to try and take its cut. My response to that is, you know, the biggest benefit right now, in my opinion, is not using Bitcoin in trade. It's using it as savings, because I think most people have sort of understood over time Bitcoin is appreciating in value. It's a very bumpy ride, of course, but it's appreciating in value. And there's a story of the person who bought two pizzas with 10,000 Bitcoin, which are worth, I think, $300 million now. Most people who have sort of looked at Bitcoin for a while recognize it's better just to hold on to it for the long term as a form of savings. And so those people are not actually being taxed at all. There's no capital gains if you don't sell your Bitcoin. The other point I would make is that I think as Bitcoin becomes money, as I believe it's going to become the world reserve currency over the next 20 to 50 years, there are going to be a lot of people who hold Bitcoin who are going to see tremendous appreciation on the value of their Bitcoin. And that's true of people already who've been holding for the long term. Those people are going to seek jurisdictions which treat them best. Mm. And I think we're going to see a flourishing of jurisdictional arbitrage. That is, people will be looking for places around the world, and places will pop up. You can believe that places will pop up. Even governments will pop up saying, we want to treat you well because we want to attract the best and brightest to our jurisdiction. And this is probably going to happen for the smaller ones, the smaller countries, which are really competing. They're almost like little companies competing to get the best people into their location. And you have this a little bit in the United States. You can't, as a US citizen, you can't escape the US federal government. Unfortunately, the long hand of the US tax man follows Americans even when they go overseas and they live overseas, which is absolutely outrageous in my opinion. But inside the US, you have different states and people do move. There are a lot of people in California, for example, where the crazy tax and spend Democrats have been continually increasing taxes over the last decade to the point where I think the maximum marginal rate in California is close to 15%. And you have to add that on top of the federal tax. So that's a big, big hit if you live in California. So what do people do? They say, well, this isn't worth it. What am I getting from being here in California? Is it the case that we have better roads or better schools in California than they have in Texas? No, absolutely not. They don't. It's obvious. You can go across the border, go to Texas, and now you're not paying any income tax, no state income tax, and you're not losing anything for that because the quality of roads and schools in Texas is, if anything, better than California. So you do see this jurisdictional arbitrage happening within the United States as the amount of savings held by citizens in America in Bitcoin increases, there will be a very, very powerful incentive for jurisdictional arbitrage and people will leave. And there are Bitcoiners who have left. And I think, you know, if the United States doesn't figure this out, it's going to lose some of its most talented people and some of its wealthy people as well. So that's the great thing about Bitcoin is that you can hold it and it's very hard for any government to take away from you. Also very hard for any government to debase. It's not possible for them to debase. And you can leave with your Bitcoin. You don't need permission. Whereas if you have some stocks in a stock market account, it's very hard to leave with that. It's very hard to transport that to another country because it can easily be seized or pulled back, whereas Bitcoin can't be pulled back or seized in that way. So I think it's a very powerful tool for people to escape oppressive regimes and oppressive in the sense of oppressive taxation as well.
Can you close here with maybe an item or two from the news or just anything recent, any recent developments involving Bitcoin that are helping to fuel your optimism? Because sometimes we read headlines that are kind of downers, like such and such government is clamping down on Bitcoin or such and such person is dumping his Bitcoin or whatever. By contrast, are there developments these days where, you know, your heart is warmed?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you two examples. One that comes to my mind is it doesn't necessarily speak to optimism about the price of Bitcoin, but it speaks to my optimism in terms of the transformative nature of Bitcoin. And it's a story in the New York Times about a Venezuelan who was trying to escape Venezuela and he was able to use his Bitcoin to restart his life. He was able to get out of the country and have a life, have his savings. He could take his savings with him because other things would be very hard to take out of Venezuela, you know, crossing the border and having the border guards, you know, rifle through your things and make sure you're not taking anything valuable out. That was really inspiring to me, because the example I like to think of is the great Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises, and how he fled Europe right in front of the Nazis. And he arrived in America with almost no money, and he had to restart his life with none of his savings. And he was a great, great professor and academic in Europe, and was treated very poorly in America. And he was sort of given a very lowly post as a professor of economics. And that's a great tragedy. He wasn't able to take all of his savings when he escaped. Of course, it was great that he survived, and we all benefited from that. So I'm inspired by the examples of people using Bitcoin as a means of preserving their freedom. That's really inspiring to me. In terms of like news for the price action, I think people are probably a little bit concerned about Bitcoin's price dropping. But if you've been, you know, in this space for long enough, you know, this is just part of the process of monetization, is that it's not linear, it's bumpy, and it happens in waves. But to me, the one thing that's really encouraging is seeing institutions and corporations starting to recognize Bitcoin's importance and slowly but surely starting to adopt it. And I think that process is going to happen over time. And I think that's also a very important part of Bitcoin becoming a world reserve currency, is that corporations and institutions will keep it on their balance sheet, because they are starting to recognize what individuals have recognized, that when you have excess savings, it's better to keep them in something like Bitcoin that appreciates over time rather than in cash that depreciates over time, with governments that are hell-bent on debasing their own money as a way of appropriating savings from their populations. So I find it encouraging that we're moving to that next transitional stage at companies like MicroStrategy and Square and Tesla, and a number of financial institutions have all recognized that Bitcoin is a superior form of money, and they're adopting it.
Well, the book we've been discussing is The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. Now, I'm going to make sure that on the show notes page, people can get it. And that's tomwoods.com/1910. But can you talk about, just for a second, about this book itself? Because I guess it's the fruit of, I mean, originally it started as an article, then you expanded it. But I see there's a Kickstarter attached to it, and I'm not sure it's on Amazon. So what's the story?
Yeah, so you're a very successful author, so you probably know this more than perhaps your listeners. But I learned something when I was creating this book, which is authors generally aren't paid very much. If you use a publisher and you sell a book for $20, as an author, you're lucky to get $1 or $2 out of that. Even if you self-publish, that is, you know, use your own service to do all the editing and the printing of the books, and then you sell those books through a retailer like Barnes & Noble, you only get maybe $5 or $6. So, you know, on the advice of a bunch of other authors in the space, I self-published, and I'm basically selling directly through this service called Kickstarter, which is a really neat way of selling things that you want to invent or create, like board games or gadgets or books even. So that's the place that you can find my book now. I launched it on Kickstarter just as a temporary campaign for about a month. And if any of your listeners hear this, hear the episode as it airs, they'll be able to find the book on Kickstarter. It'll eventually be on Amazon, but for the people who I think were most interested in the book and learning more about Bitcoin, I wanted to be able to sell directly. And the great thing for me is that instead of getting, you know, $1 or $2 or even $5, for a $20 book, I'll be getting like $17 or $18. So it's just a great tool for authors to launch things like books.
I honestly think it's brilliant what you did. I thought it was just breathtaking when I looked at it, saw how well you did, and it's something you love doing. What a perfect combination of all wonderful things coming together to yield us this book. So The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Boyapati. So glad that we were able to have this conversation. I'm linking to the book at tomwoods.com/1910. I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, this issue is not going away. We'll have ample opportunity to discuss it again in the future, and I'll look forward to having you on again. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks, before we go, I want you to know about a friend of mine who has a podcast that I think you'll find interesting. That's my friend Matt Asher, and he has a show called The Filter, and it's about the lenses through which we view our world. It features long-form conversations with top thinkers on a wide range of topics. So past guests have included Jeff Deist on the meaning of money, Russ Roberts on epistemology, Peter Godfrey Smith on octopus intelligence, Vin Armani on mimetic culture, Scott Aronson on quantum randomness, and Katie Herzog on the new colonialism. You'll find The Filter on your favorite podcast app or at mattasher.com. So go check that out, everybody. Tomorrow, I guess I'm going to have to try to do an episode on these Fauci emails. Oh my gosh, this is the last thing in the world I want to do is wade through these things. But it seems like if I don't do an episode on that, everybody would be asking me, where in heaven's name is the episode on that? So we'll do that. But then next week, we're going to cover different topics altogether. But tomorrow, I think it's going to be those doggone emails. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.